Hello, everybody. Dr. Ben Edwards here. Welcome to another episode of You're the Cure. We are really excited to have you joining us today. We've got a special guest, a return repeat guest. I think this is episode 3 or 4 that we've had with Dr. Stephanie Seneff, and she's always a favorite amongst our listeners. So we're so excited to be able to talk to Dr. Seneff again. And real quick intro here, Dr. Stephanie Seneff is Senior Research Scientist at the Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory at MIT. But her work has, over the years, shifted and focused. In the past, we've really honed in on glyphosate and the devastating effects of glyphosate, which is the main ingredient in Roundup, which everybody around West Texas is familiar with, Roundup Ready Cotton. And we're all breathing in this Roundup, unfortunately, and I think drinking it in too in our water. So we've talked about that, and Dr. Seneff has done a lot of great work in that area. But her work has shifted over time. And also I want to mention vitamin D. We have a great episode on sunshine and vitamin D. So you can go back. It's actually on our archive page, veritasmedical.com. You can find our archived radio shows there. And it's on our most popular list. You will scroll down and see that that show we did on, about vitamin D and sunshine. So Dr. Seneff has done a lot of different research. But I've asked her to come on the show today to really help continue to drive home the point that we've been making in regards to the COVID-19 gene therapy injection that people are calling a vaccine, and also just COVID in general, and the all-cause mortality we've talked about before. So we're just going to bring a lot of this together, and with the research and the point of view and the expertise, get Dr. Seneff's opinion on some of these matters. So we're really excited. Dr. Stephanie Seneff, thank you for joining us today on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. So let's just dive right in. And my audience have heard from Dr. Ryan Cole, Dr. Peter McCullough, some Dr. Brian Artis, and some of these other folks that have kind of been on the front lines out there, both in treatment, but now also bringing light and truth to the conversation on the, again, what we're calling a vaccine. And let me just preface for the audience, I think I've said this before, but I'm not opposed to a gene therapy injection potentially that could help someone who's missing certain genetic material. You know, there's certain diseases, cystic fibrosis and other ones where there's just damaged or mutated or missing genetic material. I've talked about publicly a little girl at my previous practice down in Post who was born with a very exceedingly rare genetic disease. I think there were just a handful of cases ever in the medical literature. And the life expectancy on that particular genetic disease is less than 20 years old. And so if there was a therapy that could deliver that genetic material to her, even if she had to have the therapy repeatedly, like every 6 months, go have a shot to get this gene inserted into her. If that proved to be beneficial and it proved to extend life expectancy beyond that 20 years, I would be all for exploring that. As with any medical, modern medical procedure, we have to consider risk and benefit, obviously. And if the risk of the shot delivering that genetic material outweighs the benefit, then we obviously don't want to do that probably. But so I'm not opposed to this technology in general. And I don't think really many doctors are in general opposed to that technology. But there's a level of confidence that we need in new therapies in particular, and especially in therapies that in the past have proven hard to find efficacy and safety. And specifically, Moderna came out in 2018 and told their investors that they were going to give up on this lipid nanoparticle gene therapy delivery system because it was too basically impossible to find the sweet spot where they get the dose high enough that it can deliver the genetic material. It was too toxic. When they lowered the dose so it decreased toxicity, the dose was too low to deliver the genetic material, and they just couldn't find that spot of sweet spot. And so they basically gave up on the technology. So we have the historical background here of difficulty in finding safety and efficacy on a gene therapy injection like this. And then suddenly we roll it out to the world without the evidence that there's safety there. And because our authorities haven't done a good enough job of explaining all this, people are turning to shows like this one and guests like Dr. Seneff to explain the science and explain some of the concerns. So, Dr. Seneff, sorry about that long intro, but I wanted to lay that foundation there for folks to know. I don't want to speak for you, but we're not anti some genetic technology necessarily, or even vaccines necessarily, if there's a benefit that outweighs any risk. So, with that being said, I'm just going to give you the floor to kind of start where you want, maybe with why did you start even looking at COVID, at the gene therapy injections? What kind of piqued your interest to get in the game of looking at this and producing research publishing papers in regards to this particular topic?
Right. Of course, I've been concerned about vaccines for a long time. I've been studying autism, and vaccines were one of the first things I looked at with potential risk in autism. I do believe they're a factor. Of course, I got into glyphosate and really jumped on it, because I think glyphosate is the primary cause of the epidemic in autism, and also the epidemic in diabetes and obesity and issues with high blood pressure and Alzheimer's. I mean, there are many, and various cancers. There's many, many things that are diseases that are going up dramatically in our society in step with a dramatic rise in glyphosate. So I really do think glyphosate's very important. And I also think glyphosate may be the reason why it seems to me that Western countries and countries that use a lot of glyphosate are having a much harder time controlling COVID than countries that don't. And you can look at Africa, where the death rates are way down compared to those in the United States and Brazil and Europe, and those are all heavy users of glyphosate. I think glyphosate is destroying the immune system. It's weakening the innate immune system and making the person unable to fight off the virus when they get infected. So that was where I started. Was as soon as I saw COVID, I thought of glyphosate. And you have the correlation with people who have these comorbidities. You know, people who are fat or who have diabetes, they have a much higher risk of dying from COVID. And they're also the people who I think are being exposed to glyphosate because it's causing those diseases. So that was my first thing. As soon as COVID hit, I got interested in COVID and I started studying the disease, you know. And of course, I got interested in the whole question of the origin and all of that. And there were so many. So it's been a wild time in history, because every time you turn around, there's another mystery that you don't really necessarily trust the answer that the government is giving you. And when the vaccine started to get, you know, showing up, warp speed, right? Warp speed production of these vaccines. It should have taken 12 years to develop. I didn't know anything about mRNA technology when I first heard about it and that they were going to try to get this going. But I immediately started researching even before the vaccines came out. Back when I first heard about warp speed, I got worried because I thought you can't rush a new technology like that. And which is what they did. They skipped a whole bunch of steps, you know, and very inadequate testing before they rolled it out and gave it and forced it on many people over the entire world, which totally shocked me. I just had no idea they would be so aggressive with this technology. And when you look back on the whole story, the question of lab origin, the question of early treatment, you know, they're going to keep denying early treatment. You've got to, you know, just wait till you're sick enough to go to the hospital. And then excess deaths, you know, in our country because we're not treating it early like other countries are. The whole thing started to look like a plan to me, you know, and I've been hearing Plandemic. I watched that show, Plandemic, you know, and you start to get really suspicious. I do that the whole thing was planned, you know, that and whether it was actually released intentionally from the lab or whether they simply knew because they were saying, oh, when that pandemic is coming, they were warning us long before it even, you know, right up to when this happened, they were concerned about a pandemic upcoming, possibly because they knew they had these labs that were sloppy and leaks could happen. And so, but then they kind of thought, well, if we can just convince people to go through all the shenanigans that they've pushed us through and get them to be terrified of this virus, then we can go ahead and roll out our new technology and we can make a killing. And I think it's not just we're going to make these mRNA vaccines and they're going to solve the COVID problem, but we're going to then turn around and make all kinds of other mRNA vaccines that are going to do great things, like you said, you know, possibly even solving some of these genetic defects, which would be awesome. But they wanted so much to get this technology out the door, I think, that they thought this is a great way to do it, really just get the public completely prepared to accept this massive vaccination campaign And then it will become accepted by the public, and then we can go ahead and do everything else that we plan to do and make a lot of money. So that's the way I see it, you know.
Well, there's lots of evidence for that. We've had David Martin on the show who's laid out a good case just looking at the patents going back many, many years. Of course, Event 201, Klaus Schwab's book, The COVID-19, The Great Reset, Dr. Peter Breggin will have on the show soon. And he's got, I think, 2,000 different references in his book.
Yeah, I read his book. Yeah, I've read Mercola's book. Mercola and Ron Cummings.
We've had Ron Cummings on the show talking about it. So there's plenty of evidence. That's not a, you know, just some pie in the sky theory. There's plenty of evidence. So I think that's a logical conclusion. I've come to the same conclusion. And especially in regards to the early treatment. I mean, we've treated patients in our clinic and saw a tremendous, you know, benefit from that, had a very high success rate from a mortality standpoint. And to not have the government or public health officials get on board with that was the thing that got me.
I know. That was so clear, wasn't it? It was just amazing how hard they worked to suppress it, you know, and then to cover people who dared to use it. I mean, that is just really criminal in my mind.
Yeah, and hopefully the truth will come to light in that, and there will be consequences to that action, but we'll see. And I do want to go back real quick. I want to reinforce what Dr. Simft was explaining on glyphosate, because we do talk about so many different factors out there, whether it's 5G, it's gluten, it's this or that, aluminum. We had Dr. Chris Exley on the show a couple months ago talking about aluminum, and he made the statement to me on the show that basically he doesn't think Alzheimer's could exist if there was no aluminum in the body. Mm-hmm. But usually it's a synergistic effect that glyphosate disrupts so many pathways. It opens up the barriers in the gut and the brain. And so there's this combination of things. But as Dr. Sinev said, her opinion on the glyphosate, it's such a big deal. And I talk about building resiliency in the body. We can't avoid every single toxicity out there, especially the EMF stuff now. But if you can have resiliency and removing glyphosate from the body really goes a long way to building that resiliency where you can kind of take some of these other hits. So I just wanted to kind of throw that in there from a terrain perspective. We talk about build the terrain and kind of ignore the germ almost. So glyphosate's a big, big deal. So thank you for mentioning that. So as you started diving in and you came to this conclusion, it looks like this is kind of a plan. I'll let you speak some to COVID itself, this virus, or is it a virus, this genetic sequence and the spike protein, and was it a lab origin or not, and just some of the genetic part of this thing. Do you have some thoughts in regards to that?
Right. Yeah, it is an interesting virus because it has a unique, furin cleavage site. You've probably heard about the furin cleavage site, which is a unique a sequence that allows it to be chopped in half. And this is different from SARS-CoV-1. So there's a change, you know, from that one to this one. Furin cleavage site is something we know. We know exactly what that sequence is. And we know how to make any sequence we want because we have this incredible technology today, which is really scary to me. We can just turn out whatever we want. So certainly we had the capability to insert that into the genome of some pre-existing virus. We could do that. And so whether we did do that or not, you know, open question, but it seems very suspicious. And all the studies that have been looking at natural origin have really kind of just fallen apart. Like they haven't really found a way to make that work, the natural origin story. Whereas the lab story makes a lot of sense, you know, because they were actually working on SARS-CoV viruses. They found those viruses in that bat cave, you know, and they came into the lab and they were using them and they were studying them. And some say they were trying to develop an AIDS vaccine using the coronavirus as a base for that. We don't know, you know, exactly. I don't know exactly what they were doing, but I can easily imagine they were doing something that would have caused original SARS-CoV-1 virus to turn into something different that could be a lot more toxic. And whether there's this whole question of gain of function research and, you know, the U.S. was involved and we were told to stop, Fauci, you know, was involved with that. That's also very suspicious. And then they took the money offshore to China because they could, it looks like, to avoid, you know, the scrutiny. But the money was coming from us into that project, which is also quite interesting. The whole story is just quite shocking and sort of unbelievable. And people will say, you know, conspiracy theory, but it all makes sense to me. It seems completely plausible that it was lab origin.
Yeah. Well, getting back to the injections, the gene therapy injections. So you weren't familiar, and nor was I, with mRNA and lipid nanoparticles. So as you started to dive into that research, what did you start to find, and did it concern you?
Yes, well, I immediately found a lot, and I teamed up with my buddy Greg Nye. Dr. Greg Nye and I have written several papers together. He's a great guy. He's a naturopathic oncologist, really smart person, and we've really enjoyed working together. And so we dived in, and we started reading everything we could about the messenger RNA technology, going back and seeing where their problems were and what their solutions were and what did they end up with, you know. And the whole thing looked really dangerous to us. We could not believe this stuff could be safe, you know. And we wrote the paper, we published the paper, and we started writing that paper right away, and it took a while to go through the review process, but it got published in May of last year. You know, worse than the disease was the question. Worse than the disease, question mark, was the title, and then it had a subtitle that was talking about the potential risk of these vaccines. And we found a lot of things. And one of the things we worried about several things that turned out to be true. So I feel very proud of us for that paper, because we were predicting things that hadn't really been seen yet. And so one was the idea that the vaccine was going to drive the emergence of a variant that were resistant to it. We suspected that. And that was because we had seen a story about a person in the UK who caught COVID. He had already had a pretty serious cancer situation, so he was not healthy. He was taking immune-suppressing drugs. He caught COVID. He ended up in the hospital in the UK for 101 days. He was in the hospital, and they tried hard to fix him, but they couldn't. They injected some of these antibodies from people who had recovered from COVID to sort of like giving him a vaccine on the spot. You know, they gave him these antibodies, hoping the antibodies would be able to contain the virus, and they didn't, because his immune system, his innate immune system, was so weak it couldn't respond to the antibodies. So the virus continued to thrive and even continued to mutate to resist the antibodies that were there. Over those 101 days, the virus was rapidly changing itself to try to, because it kept surviving even though there were those antibodies, the survivors. It's that whole process of evolution that happens when you get antibiotic-resistant bugs. The same thing was going on. So the virus mutated into a new form that had many different mutations. They were tracking his particular strain over time, and they saw that it started changing quickly once he got those antibodies from other people. So that's exactly what you're doing. If you give a vaccine to someone who's immune compromised, you're setting up a field day for the virus to figure out how to get around the antibodies. So you only need one person to produce a new virus that happens to be very virulent. Because it's survived in this environment with these antibodies, it's come out with a really good solution to get around them. And now you've got all these, you know, then it will start multiplying everywhere because it will be so resistant, even to the antibodies other people produce in response to it. So now you've got a new strain that's going to take over, and it's not going to work with the antibodies that you've got. So when you do a vaccine of a weak person and you produce a new bug and that bug takes off, and eventually you've got a virus that is resistant to the vaccine that you're delivering. And we're in that situation now with Omicron. You know, Omicron is actually a gift from God, in my opinion, because it's less dangerous. It's more like the flu. It's extremely infectious, and it's beating out all the other strains that are more dangerous than it is. And it resists the vaccines. You know, it's very good at surviving in spite of the vaccines. So the vaccines become a lot less effective because of Omicron. And now here we are trying to roll out a fourth shot, you know, a second booster. They're encouraging people even as young as 50 to get a second booster in the United States. And it's foolish because we've already got Omicron, which is already resistant. And Omicron's going to turn into something else that's even more resistant. You can predict that's what's going to happen. So the vaccines don't even work anymore. They worked for a short time. The other thing was they fade. You know, you get a sweet spot 2 weeks after your second shot, you're in good shape, and you can probably, you know, be very confident you won't get sick in that period. But then immediately the antibodies start fading, and they're gone. You know, they're useless by 6 months. You need to get your booster, and then the booster's useless even quicker, apparently. So we're going to get four shots every year. You know, it's pretty frightening to me to think of injecting that kind of really a toxic load, and I will get to that part in a moment. Every four months, let's say, maybe three times a year. to take that assault is going to be really, really bad on our health, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Could you, I was going to go to the acquired immunodeficiency syndrome that we're kind of, there's clues to that coming. But before we go there, I want to let you hit on what else you and Dr. Nye found besides driving resistance in these resistant strains. What were some of the other concerns about this technology as y'all were diving into your research?
Yeah, we had a section, a pretty long section on the idea that it could get turned into DNA and could become a permanent part of the human genome. And we found.
Did you get pushback at the time on that? Because I remember the press saying, "Oh, there's no way this is going to turn. This is not going to modify your DNA." And then I saw y'all's paper.
Right. You have the fact checkers, right? The fact checkers say there's no way. Yeah. And it was, and actually there's the I found a announcement. There was a thing that was saying how great these vaccines are from early on, right? Like say December 2020. Is that right? Yeah. And they And they said point blank, there's no way it's going to turn into DNA. No way, it's just not true. So they were going right out front to say that it couldn't happen. But what's happened now is that there's been a study that ran used a culture of human cells that were liver cancer cells, and they exposed them. They basically gave them the vaccine, and they made the spike protein and everything, but then they did turn the mRNA into DNA, and they figured out how they did it. They used LINE1, which is a really unique sequence in the genome that's able to produce all the tools you need to turn RNA into DNA. Really fascinating. And that was something I knew about the retroviruses. In fact, I actually worked in a lab many, many years ago where they were studying retroviruses. And I knew the retroviruses could turn RNA into DNA. That was a really strong feature of these unique viruses. But I hadn't known until I started looking into RNA vaccines that humans have those proteins too. We can also turn RNA into DNA. And our cells do it when they're stressed, under stress conditions. And our immune cells can do it. The sperm can do it, which is very, very interesting to me. The sperm, the immune cells, and cancer cells are all express this LINE1, which can turn RNA, foreign RNA, into DNA. And Greg and I found a paper from 2010 that was really fascinating. It talked about sperm and exposed the sperm to foreign messenger RNA, which they took up, which they converted to DNA, and they released as plasmids, these little pellets, little lipid pellets. I think they're probably lipid pellets that contain these this DNA. And they release them at the time of fertilization, all the sperm, not just the one that fertilized the egg. It's all over the medium. The fertilized egg actually takes these plasmids up, and the fetus becomes permanently endowed with the ability to make, for example, the spike protein, if it were to happen with the vaccine. The fetus can become, can have these plasmids and carry these plasmids forward into its adult life, all the way to adult life, and can even pass them on to its children. And potentially those plasmids could later eventually become integrated into the human genome. So this was really, really amazing to me that this could happen. And then if you have cancer, it's more likely to happen, because the cancer cells are doing that. And if an adult has cancer, gets the plasmids are released into their circulation. They've got spike protein, the capacity to make spike protein for the rest of their life, I think. Anyway, so we talked about that, and then the study showed up recently that I think totally proved that we were right.
Yeah. So I would be probably a little boastful too, or proud of, and frustrated. Y'all looked into the research, you found these things, you were trying to warn folks, and others were trying to warn folks, and now, after exposure of millions of people to this thing, that there's evidence that y'all were correct. So the resistance to the virus, the ability of mRNA to turn into DNA, did y'all look at the lipid nanoparticles? Was that another part of the concern? Okay.
That's the third thing. That's the third thing. And I think we hit gold, to be honest with you. I've looked much more into that, and I think we're spot on. And we talked about the potential, the whole process, and I think we're going to have a break in a moment, but we'll get back to that after the break. But I want to just introduce it, because the whole process by which the immune cells end up taking up the vaccine, they go into the lymph system, they end up in the spleen in large numbers. In the spleen, they're coping with all this spike protein they can't stop making, and they release it in the form of these exosomes. And the exosomes travel along nerve fibers, and they make their way to the heart, to the brain, to the liver, to the gut, and they cause a lot of trouble.
Yeah. Well, you're right. We are up against a break. I want to expand on that thought. And then we're also going to get into the paper that you put out, you wrote with Kathy Dopp about all-cause mortality data. So we want to dive into that topic and more. So y'all stick with us. We are with Dr. Stephanie Seneff. Again, this show will be recorded and archived on our website, veritasmedical.com. Also, you can find it as a podcast, You're the Cure, on iTunes, Apple Podcasts. So thank y'all for being with us today. We will be right back. Stick with us. You're the Cure. All right, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us again. We are doing the second half of the hour here with Dr. Stephanie Seneff. We're talking glyphosate. We're talking COVID vaccine / gene therapy technology, the pros and cons of that. And unfortunately, mostly it's cons. And before we went to the break, Dr. Seneff was explaining some of the concerns that she and Dr. Nye put in their original paper when they looked at this technology. One of the concerns was the potential for the virus to mutate easily and the vaccine to pressure the virus to mutate to a resistant strain. Another concern was this mRNA could get incorporated into the DNA and long-term potential for spike protein production out of our own human cells. And then thirdly, we were just getting into before the break, the lipid nanoparticles. So did you want to expand more on that, Dr. Seneff, the concern about lipid nanoparticles?
Right. I mean, I think that's absolutely critical. I think it's the key story, actually. It's in my opinion, and that's because I've looked at the virus database, Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, and they have all kinds of evidence of side effects that are related to the vagus nerve. And I think what is happening is that these immune cells, they come into the muscle. The muscle gets hit hard by the vaccine, and muscle cells take up this, it looks like an LDL particle, only it's got this cationic lipid that's extremely toxic. So that's also upsetting the cells. The cells are very upset about the situation, and they're making all this spike protein, they're displaying it, they're drawing in the immune cells into the muscle. The immune cells take up this stuff as well, and that's something very different from the disease, because in the disease, it comes in through the ACE2 receptors, the virus. The immune cells don't have those ACE2 receptors, so they are, in some sense, immune to the virus. They're there to fight, but they're not going to get sick from it, whereas with the mRNA, they take it up, too, equally, because they're very good at taking up LDL particles. They get stuck making all this spike protein. So they're in a situation they've never seen before. Here I am making this poison, and I can't stop doing it because the RNA is designed to be extremely sturdy. It's stealth because it's been designed to fool the body into thinking that it's a human RNA molecule. It doesn't look like a virus molecule. And then it sticks around for a long time, and it's also been designed to not be able to shut down. So they chose particular human sequences that would protect it from either being degraded or from stopping to make protein. So it keeps on making protein. The body can't stop making it. And a recent study showed it was still around in the lymph nodes 60 days later after the vaccine. Amazing to me, because I thought, they said, that's the other thing, they said it would disappear in a couple of days, and it actually lasts at least 6 months, because they stopped looking at 6 months. But it was still there in the lymph nodes 6 months later. So it's very sturdy RNA. The immune cells pick it up. They say their only thought is, I've got to get this to the B cells and T cells so they can make some antibodies, because that's the only way we're going to stop this mess. And they know they're part of the problem. I think of these as little animated, humans or something, because the cells have a whole policy. They know how to do things, but then when they're stuck on something, they don't know what to do. They're going to rush into the immune system and travel along the lymph system and end up, and they show it in a study from Japan. The spleen had the highest level of all the organs. It was also, they said it would always stick in the muscle and would never go anywhere. That wasn't true. So it's highest levels in the in the spleen, and then the ovaries were the second highest for the females, which is really disturbing to me because it's going to cause inflammation and damage to the ovaries, which can't be good for the reproductive system. And then the liver also was right there behind the spleen. So that's also going to be liver damage. And you see liver damage, very, very clear evidence of it in the VARS database. So anyway, it goes into the spleen, and in the spleen, it goes to these germinal centers, and those germinal centers are where the action is to make the antibodies. So it does a superb job of producing extremely high levels of antibodies, higher than most people when they recover from the disease. They don't need that kind of antibodies, you know, to such a high level. So it's spectacularly successful at its goal of making these extremely high antibodies to the spike protein. But of course, it only makes antibodies to spike, whereas if you catch the disease, you've got a whole bunch of other proteins. And some of those proteins are a lot more stable than the spike protein. So when you make antibodies to those internal proteins through the disease process, those last much longer, and they're not going to get this problem of the virus mutating its way out of a jam. So it's not making antibodies that are as useful as the ones you would get if you caught the disease. But so those immune cells in the spleen are making all this protein, and they're pushing it to their membrane, but they're also packaging it up inside these exosomes and releasing it into the circulation as these little lipid particles. They're much smaller than LDL particles, but they can contain all kinds of interesting things. I've become fascinated with exosomes because I think they are a sort of a communication network for the cells. And cells under stress release these exosomes and put things into them that actually instruct the receiver of what to do with this stuff. And so they put in these things called microRNAs into the exosomes. And there's like thousands of different microRNAs. Those are short sequences of non-coding RNA. They're very, very interesting because they can affect policy. They can affect the cell's expression of different proteins, change its policy as far as how it's operating when it receives these microRNAs. And so the immune cells have put specific microRNAs packaged up with these spike proteins and shipped them out to the whole body to try to feed, you know, somebody else take this stuff and do something with it, because I can't. I'm too busy because I'm making so much of it, I can't control it. So they're releasing it, distributing it. And those exosomes travel very nicely along nerve fibers. And this is something that has been shown with Parkinson's disease. I actually understood all of this before I met these vaccines, because I'd been studying Parkinson's disease. And I was aware that I was fascinated with Parkinson's. My mother died of it, so I have an interest, you know, in case I might have the same genetics. But they said Parkinson's, they believe it starts in the gut, and it starts with viruses or you know, if some kind of a pathogen that produces a misfolding of what's called a prion-like protein, a protein that can misfold the way prion proteins misfold, and can cause it can seed the misfolding of other proteins, including human proteins, that can then cause really bad neurodegenerative diseases. And so I've been really all over this topic because I'm so fascinated with it, not just Parkinson's, but of course the prion protein itself, the human prion protein, is the cause of the human prion disease, which is the equivalent of mad cow in the cows. And our form is called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, CJD. That is an extremely bad neurodegenerative disease that is, you really don't want to catch that. And I have to take a little side here and say that there was a preprint paper that came out on CJD from Europe, and Luc Montagnier was one of the authors on it. He recently died. He was he won the Nobel Prize for his research on AIDS, but he was one of three authors on this preprint paper where they had found 16 people who had developed CJD shortly after their second vaccine. All 16, it was after the second vaccine, maybe a month later, diagnosed with CJD. And by the end of a year, most of them were dead, and the remaining ones were in really bad shape. So it's basically, you know, killing these people. CJD is an extremely rare disease. Only 1 in 1,000 people catch it ever in their life. Extremely rare. And these 16 people, 6 of them died within 3 months. 6 of them died within 8 months. And the remaining 6 were barely alive by the time they wrote the paper. So it's just really Did I do that right? The remaining four, sorry, there's only four left when there's 16, are still alive, but barely at the time of the writing of the paper. So it's CJD, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, ALS, all of those diseases. I believe they're going to go up in prevalence in the future because of these vaccines. And people won't immediately notice that something's happened because these diseases all take a lot of time. And they start with these misfolded foreign prion proteins, prion-like proteins that the immune cells take up in the gut, carry them to the spleen, and then they release them in these exosomes, and the exosomes travel to the brain, and then the brain cells take up these misfolded proteins, and then it can cause their own proteins to misfold in a cascade. So every time you get one of these vaccines, you've pushed that whole process down the road, and you're getting closer to the point where you're going to develop one of these degenerative diseases. These things take a lot of time. And so they've seen that Parkinson's already has, people have evidence of Parkinson's in the spleen long before they have it in the brain, before they actually have symptoms. And so I think that is really, really scary. And I think this is what's going to happen. And again, I looked at the VAERS database, and we found that there were lots of indicators of risk for neurodegenerative diseases, things like, you know, difficulty swallowing, and there are all kinds of nerves issues. So, for example, migraine headache, I think tens of thousands of cases of migraine headache, which is the trigeminal nerve being inflamed. So the vagus nerve hooks up to the trigeminal nerve. You have the tinnitus or tinnitus in ringing in the ear, lots and lots of cases. And that's, you know, inflammation in the nerves of the ear. And then you have, of course, also the heart. So you have all kinds of problems with the nerves in the brain. And even you can get to the nerves that are the control center. And I think that's how you're getting a sudden death, because we have a lot of cases. I've been looking into the cases in Vaers where they died, and especially the young people who died. And many of them are amazing, because it's kind of like, oh, well, we're having some symptoms. They were vomiting. They didn't do well with the vaccine. But we knew that was normal, so we didn't worry. And we came in the next morning, and they were dead in their bed. You know, young people just suddenly dying for no good reason. They didn't have a disease process that looked like it was going to kill them. And I think that's because they're getting damage to critical centers in the brain that control things like breathing. So, and consciousness. You know, we have a lot of people losing consciousness. All of these things are indicators of damage to nerves. And so I think that we're right that what's happening is that the immune cells are congregating in germinal centers, releasing exosomes that contain spike, shipping them to the brain, and causing tremendous trouble. Tremendous trouble.
Mm. Well, would you care to hazard a guess on, from a therapeutic standpoint, you know, if someone did have this injection and maybe have not experienced any significant symptoms or maybe mild neurological symptoms, as far as an antidote or a treatment or a therapy, is that something you don't want to guess on?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it looks like long haul COVID. And so the people who are learning how to treat long haul COVID are thinking that they can use the same strategies to treat this. My personal opinion would be, my guess is that the people who are susceptible to this kind of disaster suffer from sulfate deficiency problems. This is my area of expertise. I really do truly believe that systemic sulfate deficiency is a key factor in multiple modern diseases, certainly in autism and in Alzheimer's and in gut problems, you know, like colitis. All of these things are related to sulfate deficiency. And I believe that our country, our population as a whole, has a serious problem with sulfate deficiency systemically because of glyphosate. And this is something I wrote a lot about in my book, Toxic Legacy, which was published last July. Sulfate deficiency due to glyphosate. It's really, really interesting. And it fits with my theory for glyphosate's mechanism of toxicity, which is unique and diabolical. Glyphosate, I believe, substitutes for the amino acid glycine during protein synthesis. And it does so in particular places where the glycine is a highly conserved glycine residue, meaning very important to the protein, at a spot where the protein binds phosphate. And if you take that assumption, you can find specific proteins that you would suspect would be susceptible to glyphosate. And sitting right in the middle of it are all the proteins, basically, that deal with sulfate. It's quite, quite interesting because sulfate gets activated into an active form of sulfate called PAPS. And that's PAPS is sort of a sulfate carrier that can deliver sulfate to any molecule. It can transfer the sulfate and stick it onto a molecule, which is a super important thing to do. And PAPS is it was originally an ATP molecule, and it lost two of its P's, and then it gained the sulfate, and then it gained another P. So there's a really fascinating enzyme called PAPS synthase that's able to convert sulfate into PAPS, and that enzyme binds phosphate in multiple places where it has highly conserved glycines. So it gets hit hard by glyphosate, and it's supposed to be happening in the gut to make sulfate. To be able to make sulfate that's useful to, for example, line the gut lining, because when you have colitis, you have a deficiency in sulfate in the what they call the glycosaminoglycans, which is in the glycocalyx that lines the gut barrier and keeps the microbes out and keeps all toxic chemicals out too. It builds this really nice structured water in a region around the edge of the gut because of those sulfates, and it won't. It won't happen if you don't have the ability to add sulfate to the heparin sulfate proteoglycans that are lining the gut. And that's a little bit complicated there, I'm sorry. But that's really, really fascinating to me because the autism is connected very clearly to sulfate deficiency. I learned that long before I knew about glyphosate from the research that was being done by someone called Rosemary Waring back in the 1990s. And in most recently, there's a new article on autism. Really, really beautiful because it shows the pineal gland, which I've written about the pineal gland playing an important role in autism due to its defective ability to produce melatonin sulfate. That is what you need to sleep at night, melatonin sulfate. And so the pineal gland has a deficiency in the supply of melatonin because it comes from the shikimate pathway that glyphosate famously disrupts, and it has an impaired ability to add the sulfate to the melatonin. So the brain doesn't get enough melatonin sulfate. You don't sleep well, for one thing, but you also can't clear garbage for another. I mean, there's many, many things. And the neurodevelopment, the development of the brain, critically, critically depends on heparin sulfate in the infant. And so all of that's getting messed up. And this article showed that the pineal gland had severely reduced heparin sulfate levels, and it had a very practically zero capacity for the enzyme that makes this PAPS, or that transfers the sulfate to another molecule, the one that makes the melatonin sulfate, severely disabled in the autistic brain, in the pineal gland. And so that was really, really exciting to me because that fits completely with what I had been saying about the pineal gland playing an important role and about glyphosate being able to deliver aluminum to the pineal gland to mess it up. So there's a lot of stuff that makes sense there with respect to autism and glyphosate. That's a divergence. But there's also a paper I found that talked about COVID-19 and specifically talked about a deficiency in sulfation, in the heparin sulfate in the gut as being a key factor relating to bad outcomes in COVID-19. So it's connected there as well.
Okay. So from a sulfate standpoint, do you think the average person who's focused on eating real food, organic, you know, whole foods, if they have good gut flora, can they get adequate sulfur from a basic diet, or do you recommend supplementation? What are the best sources to be sure we have enough sulfur?
Yes, I have excellent questions. That's excellent questions. And that is what I think, is that our food is deficient in sulfur. That's one of the things, too, that is an issue with, you know, when they try to evaluate the food, they always think in terms of the yield, how much yield. You know, they're always focused on yield. And they're not looking at what's in the food as far as micronutrients are concerned. And glyphosate severely suppresses the uptake of sulfur into plants. And so when you're eating a plant-based diet with plants exposed to glyphosate, you're getting a sulfur-deficient diet. And of course, not only that, but your body isn't able to manage the sulfur correctly. And so people get issues with their gut when they're being exposed to glyphosate. They get discomfort because there's gas, you know, bloating. And hydrogen sulfide gas ends up being produced because of this inability to attach the sulfate to the various molecules that want it, you know. And serotonin always gets sulfated. It's made in the gut. It comes from the shikimate pathway, which glyphosate disrupts. It gets sulfated, and then it gets shipped out. And it's interesting because the ACE2 receptors actually are important for allowing
Well, and I remember from a previous conversation, vitamin D's got to be sulfated too for it to.
That's right. Vitamin D is sulfated. Cholesterol is sulfated. So when you have high cholesterol, I think it's because you've got a sulfate deficiency problem. Normally, your skin makes cholesterol sulfate as well as vitamin D sulfate in response to sunlight. And the cholesterol sulfate is very easy to get around. You know, it delivers both the cholesterol and the sulfate to the tissues. And when you're not able to do that, you've got to package the cholesterol up inside, and the vitamin D, by the way, up inside the LDL particles, which raises your LDL, which puts you on a statin drug.
A little bit of sulfur goes a long ways. Do you like MSM as a supplemental sulfur?
Yeah, MSM, yes. And I was just about to get to that because you did say supplements. And there are several supplements that people take that have sulfur in them. And MSM is a good one. I think that's probably the best one. I mean, that seems to be, from what I hear from practitioners, I don't practice and I can't really recommend things. But I think the people I know seem to think that MSM does a good job of helping to supplement. One thing I believe in is Epsom salt baths. I think that's a very easy way to get sulfate absorbed through the skin, because that Epsom salts are magnesium sulfate. So you're getting both magnesium and sulfate, both of which are probably deficient, through Epsom salt baths. So you don't have to eat. You can just soak in it, you know, and I actually do that very frequently. And just a little, I just do a kind of maintenance dose, you know, throw a little into the bath water. If you like to take a bath, and I really enjoy a hot bath, so a hot bath with a little bit of Epsom salt, I think is a very easy way to help to boost your sulfur. And, of course, I think also eating sulfur-rich foods, and I go out of my way to do that. So we eat a lot of cruciferous vegetables, onions, garlic. Garlic is a fantastic source of sulfur. So if you like garlic, use it in everything, you know, and I love garlic, so that's a big one. And then eggs, organic eggs are super, super good source of sulfur. And in general, meats, in fact, you know, animal-based foods are a better source of certain sulfur-containing molecules that are very important for health. And I think of taurine, in fact. Taurine is very interesting because it's an amino acid. It's an unusual amino acid, and it doesn't go into the proteins. It's not a coding amino acid. What is unusual about it is that it has a sulfonate attached to it. Sulfonate is almost sulfate. It just needs one more oxygen. And the gut microbes are able to convert taurine into sulfate. And the body stores taurine. It's the most common amino acid that's stored alone, you know, just as itself, rather than hooked up into proteins. And it's stored in high amounts in the liver, in the heart, in the brain. And those are all sort of really important organs. And so actually it's released from the brain under stress in an inflammation. And it's released from the heart during a heart attack. And so I think the taurine is getting released and delivered to the gut microbes so they can convert it to sulfate. So I believe that that's a mechanism in place, because when I think you have these crises, like a heart attack or even seizures, for example, under conditions of sulfate deficiency, I believe that's a major driving factor behind these issues that we're seeing. And of course, the blood gets all really in trouble too with the inadequate sulfate, because sulfate lines, heparin sulfate, lines all the blood vessels and builds this gelled water that, you know, a thin layer of gelled water that makes the capillaries very slippery, so that hides all the stuff, all the molecules inside the gelled water. And then the red blood cells can just slide through the capillaries effortlessly. That's super important. So when that's not good and working well, the red blood cells get stuck and you can get a no-flow situation. You can end up you know, for example, like a stroke or something, when you get the blood vessels blocked and things like that. So it's the blood gets in trouble when there's not enough sulfate. The circulation gets in trouble.
Sounds like we can get a lot done for our health and our terrain resiliency if we get our sulfur right. In the 10 minutes we have left, give or take 10 minutes, I want to get into I think it's your latest paper on the all-cause mortality. And I'm a big all-cause mortality guy. I started looking at all-cause mortality during COVID just early on to say, wait a minute, how many people are dying in 2020, 2019, 2018, 17, 16, going back. And I found William Farr's quote. He was a guy back in the 1800s. He said, the death rate is a fact. Everything else is an inference.
Yes, that's a good one.
Arguing about how many people died of COVID, did they die with it, from it, whatever, these numbers inflated, but yada, yada, yada. We can argue all day long. And same with this gene therapy shot. is it killing people? Are we seeing a change, you know, since it was rolled out and when the mandates came? Can we correlate death rates? So you have to look at the all-cause mortality, really, because everything else can be manipulated. So when I saw your paper come out, you and I believe it was Kathy Dobbs. So fascinating paper. I mean, what really struck me was the title, which I'll read: COVID-19 and all-cause mortality data by age group reveals risk of COVID vaccine-induced fatality is equal to or greater than the risk of COVID-19 death for all age groups under 80 years old as of February 6, 2022. That is a big statement, a big title, big statement, eye-opening. How did you come to that conclusion?
Right, yeah. Most of the work was actually done by a couple of people at Columbia University. One of them is at Columbia University, and it's a preprint, so it has not been peer-reviewed. But they did a really big study. I thought it was excellent. They looked at the United States data at the state level, and they got data on mortality data. So as you say, it's pretty clear the guy died, right? So mortality data from the states on a monthly basis. So every month, you know, how many people died in that state, what percentage of the population. And they did a very clever, very extensive analysis where they looked, and this is a trick you can, you know, when you do analyses like this, you can, if you don't want to succeed, you sort of throw in all the data and you get a lot of noise data, and then the noise masks the signal. Well, they didn't do that. So they looked at specific situations that were specific to the knowledge about when was the vaccine administered. So for the old people, they looked in the early months, you know, of the year, which is when they were all getting vaccinated, and they looked month by month, you know, the previous month, the following month, the death rate, and they looked at the vaccine rate. So the month in which they got a lot of vaccines, what was their death rate the next month? So they were looking at the notion of the vaccine killing you within a month kind of thing. It's a very rough measure, but you do these massive statistical analyses, you can find things. And then for the younger people, they were showing up like August. They could see August, September, as soon as they did the massive rollout of the younger people, then the next month, what was the death rate? So they were looking at that differential in the death rate for various age groups and for the times in which, you know, they were getting massive vaccine doses. And by restricting their study to a subset of the data that fit with when the vaccine was being administered in high numbers so they could get a signal, they found a really shocking result that showed quite a much higher death rate from the vaccine than what's being reported. You know, and of course, the VAERS database, people argue it's clearly underreported. Whether it's, you know, what is the factor? People are kind of kicking around a factor of 41 has been kind of showing up in my circles. For every report in the database, there's 41 that happened but were not recorded. And of course, the vaccine, you know, it's a causal factor. I think many people are getting many things shortly after the vaccine that they don't realize the vaccine is a causal factor. You know, they already have some health condition, like a cancer, and their cancer gets worse right after the vaccine. They don't attribute it to the vaccine. There's so many things that are happening to people. Their aches and pains suddenly get much worse. You know, all these things are happening because it's a massive dose of poison that your body's coping with that vaccine, I think. And so it causes troubles in different ways for different people, depending upon how their body's working, you know. But and people could die after the vaccine and not think the vaccine. Like if you just woke up, you know, you came to your son and he was dead in the morning, you don't have a clue what happened, you know, what caused that. It's extremely unusual. But what caused it, you don't know, right? If he had a vaccine a week ago, I would suspect the vaccine. So, but anyway, so that was what they did. They showed they got numbers for each age group. They had specific age groups that they identified, and they got numbers for the percentage of the people that were dying within a month of the vaccine. And then so all we did was we got some data from the U.S. and from the U.K., that were reporting death rates from COVID. And again, U.S. has data monthly, so we could do the same similar kind of thing of estimating percentages and figuring out for the different age groups, figuring out how many people died from COVID in those age groups. And of course, in the younger age groups, they were practically zero, very, very low death rate from COVID. And in those cases, the numbers that these Columbia people came out with were much higher, much higher death rate from the vaccine than what we were seeing from COVID. And we were looking in December, January, when COVID was on fire in both the UK and the US. So this is kind of a worst case scenario, because right now, of course, in the US, we're looking pretty good. Most people, I think, have some kind of immunity at this point. And so COVID numbers are way down. Right now, it would be no question for everybody that the vaccine is a waste of money and a waste of time, and it's going to hurt you more than it's going to help you statistically, you know, for sure now. Because even at the peak of COVID, it was the vaccine wasn't very helpful against the variant, so that was working against them as well then. But for now, for sure, nobody. It doesn't make sense, in my opinion, for anybody to get this vaccine at this point, if we believe the numbers of those Columbia people. And that, of course, is questionable. They haven't gotten it peer reviewed yet. So, you know, one always has to. But they're a good team. They're smart. And they did some very interesting modeling to figure that out.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would encourage people to go back and listen to we've interviewed Dr. Jessica Rose talking about the underreporting factor. Also, Steve Kirsch has been on the show. Go back on the archive page and y'all can hear those deeper discussions on underreporting factors. And this is just another paper that would support that. And I just have to throw in that even those death rates, even in the older folks from COVID, how those could have been dramatically reduced. I think Dr. Peter McCullough's latest estimate was 95% of those could have been avoided with early treatment. And that's consistent with my clinical experience with COVID and many of my colleagues that I've interacted with and talked to and communicate with. So we have to consider that also into the equation.
Right. And once you do that, there's just no question about the vaccines being very dangerous and not at all useful, I think. If you can do the, you know, get somebody like you who can treat you when you first catch the disease and avoid getting into that perilous state.
Well, Dr. Seneff, we sure appreciate you being on the show today. I know you're a busy lady and it's an hour's a long time. So I thank you for your time today, all the insights, the information, connecting so many dots. From the research scientific point of view, you know, that helps so many people when they hear these quote unquote experts on TV who are just talking heads most of the time, it seems like, with the company line. So to hear the truth from someone as distinguished as you and the experience that you have and the publications that you've put forth. So thank you for all your hard work, for standing for truth. I know it's not easy to be out there speaking opposite of the narrative. So thank you for all you do. Thank you for joining us today. And we look forward to having you back sometime.
Wonderful. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Okay, everybody. That was Dr. Stephanie Seneff. And I encourage y'all to go back, find the old interviews we've done with her. They're always fan favorites or crowd favorites, and they're my personal favorites too. So y'all go back to veritasmedical.com, everybody. You can check that out on our archive page. And also, we have recently launched an education and support program with our Veritas Wellness Navigators. I encourage you to get on there. Most diseases are actually consequences of diet and lifestyle choices. It's clear in the literature that this modern disease epidemic is diet and lifestyle related. So the Veritas Wellness Navigators want to teach you how to steward your health through diet and lifestyle choices and try to avoid the doctor. That's our goal, is to never come see me or one of our medical practitioners. Just stick with the ladies in the kitchen. So check that out at veritasmedical.com. Dr. Seneff, again, thank you very much for all you've done. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Okay, everyone, I'm Dr. Ben Edwards. You're The Cure. Come back next week for another great show. Bye-bye, everybody.